Thanks, Dominic. Sorry, I was supposed to come in person, but I had some unfortunate visa issues that were totally completely my fault. So apologize for not being able to be there in person, but I'm happy to be able to be here virtually nevertheless. So today I'll be talking about this work, charting the space of ground states with matrix product states. And we put out this work on the archive earlier this year. Happy to be talking about it. So let me just begin with an outline of the talk. So I'll begin with some introduction and motivation for the problem that we're the general field and the problem that we'll be considering. I'll then jump into a discussion of the setting, which is parameterized systems or families of gapped Hamiltonians. And then I'll describe this main example that we'll sort of be using to ground our intuition and also to illustrate some key points, which I'll call the churn number pump. And finally, I'll describe the explorations of this topic using the toolkit of matrix product states. And So let me just begin with this introduction. The general setting is, of course, the question of quantum phases of matter. So the typical starting point is we'll have some, say, 2D lattice with some quantum degrees of freedom associated with each site of the lattice. And so our Hilbert space is some tensor product Hilbert space of these on-site degrees of freedom. And our Hamiltonian is some sum of local terms. So this is what are called local Hamiltonians. And one thing that we learned quite early on is that, if our quantum lattice models have an energy gap between the ground state and the first excited state, then we can in fact partition this set or the space of all gapped quantum lattice models. We can partition them into equivalence classes, and these are what we'll call what are known as phases of matter. And how do we partition these lattice models into phases? Well, we'll say that two systems are in the same phase if they can be deformed into each other without closing the without preserve while preserving the gap. So this sort of formalizes the notion of adiabatic continuity, where we'll say that two systems are in the same phase if I can kind of slowly tune their parameters in such a way that I make them the same. And the reason this is useful and important is because as condensed matter physicists, we're often concerned about universal properties of systems. And almost by definition, these are, systems in the same phase are the ones that have the same universal properties. So this grouping, this partitioning into equivalence classes is really useful for us in understanding what are the key features within of the lattice model. So one question that we have is therefore, how do we classify the phase of matter? Or in other words, how do we identify, which lattice model is being in what phase of matter? So I want to take a moment to frame this question as a question in topology. So here, in this blank canvas, I've sort of schematically want to drawn I've schematically drawn the sort of space of all gapped quantum systems, space of all systems, of all quantum systems. And for the moment, now let me restrict to gap phases. So now maybe this space becomes disconnected. And here I've just indicated where the trivial product state is in this space of systems. And now we'll see that we notice that there are some regions of in this space of quantum systems that are sort of inaccessible, or that I can't connect them with this trivial product state. So we label this equivalence class of phases in which the product state lives as the trivial phase, and then we have various labels for other kinds of phases. But the key point that I want to convey with this kind of diagram is that when we're classifying or when we're trying to understand the set of gapped phases, what we're really doing is or one way of framing what we're doing is we're trying to understand what are the connected components of this space of gapped systems. So to kind of dress this up in some fancy math language, when we're classifying gapped phases, this is like we're finding pi zero, which is the set of connected components of the space of quantum systems. And dressing up in this fancy math language is useful because now I can replace this zero with some other positive integers and ask about the analogous question. Well, what about higher homotopy groups of each phase? Or more generally, like, what is the topology of this space of quantum systems beyond just what are the connected components? So it's this kind of question that the rest of the talk will be. It's this kind of context that the rest of the talk will be sort of grounded in. Oh, and please, feel free to interrupt with any questions. I don't even know if I have enough material to cover the whole hour. Feel free to interrupt with any questions. And as the last bit of motivation, let me say, address the question of why we should care about this question. At first, it might seem like just some completely academic question, like maybe everything there is to know about phases is sort of encoded there in the connected component already. But let me draw an analogy to a well-studied problem in condensed matter, which is the question of defects and textures in ordered phases. So suppose now we have some symmetry G, and this is spontaneously broken down. The ground state spontaneously breaks the symmetry down to some subgroup H. So we can imagine like a ferromagnet. Oh, yeah, please.
Sorry for the interruption. So actually in the previous slide, maybe this is not the main point, but what kind of topology are you using? Do you use some metric topology?
Yeah, sorry, that's a great question. And I would say that this question is for one thing, it's very subtle. And there are many different topologies that you can put on this space. And the reason it's subtle is because the space is like kind of horribly infinite dimensional, right? There's not, it's like totally non-compact and, so there's many different topologies that you could put on this space. There are some topologies which you can kind of rule out as being too strong, I think is the word. So for example, if you try to put like say the norm topology or something on the space of systems, it turns out that this topology is too strong. So I think the right way to do it is to start from say the weakest topology. I think it's called like the weak star topology. And but that one is a little bit too weak because this one doesn't distinguish between different phases. In fact, sort of all I believe the weak star topology is like completely connected. If you put the weak star topology on the space, it's completely connected. So the right thing to do is sort of to identify some intermediate topology on this space, and probably it would have to do with like it might be able to do some kind of metric topology where the distance corresponds to like the depth of the circuit that you need to prepare the state, for example. But I would say this question is like, it's definitely open in terms of how to formalize this.
I mean, we do have some intuitive sense of what it means for two Hamiltonians to be close to each other, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think you just need to find a formal norm that captures that intuitive sense, which I think one can do.
Yeah, I think there's some progress in this direction in those recent papers by Anton Kapustin, where he defines this notion of what is it called? Anyway, I don't remember what he calls it, but essentially it's sort of formalizing this notion of evolving with a finite depth circuit. And so, yeah, I think if you can turn that into a kind of metric topology or something, that should be sort of the right topology to use on this space.
Right. I guess what I was suggesting is maybe you should define it not in terms of states, but in terms of Hamiltonians. I think then it's pretty transparent how you would want to define it than the norm.
But in that case, I think you run into the issue of like, you know, a gap state and a gapless state could be really close to each other in Hamiltonian space. If you kind of take the, I don't know, at least.
Yeah. So you want to restrict only to Hamiltonians that have a gap.
Right. So I think if you do that, then the sort of intuitive sense works actually is, But then the hard part is figuring out where the Hamiltonians don't have a gap. I think if you restrict gap states and you impose this kind of topology, then sort of everything, maybe it comes for free, sort of which state. You always sort of get gap states out, I think.
Yeah.
Thanks for the question. Right. So yeah, the question of why do we care? I want to draw this analogy to defects in textures. So if we suppose that we have some symmetry, which is broken by the ground state down to some subgroup, then we can look at this coset space, G mod H, and it turns out that this space labels the possible ground states that you could have spontaneously broken into. It's sort of well known by now that the homotopy groups of this space, there's kth homotopy groups, these determine the codimension k plus one defects and the codimension k textures of the system. So for some examples, if we have a Z2 symmetry which is spontaneously broken to nothing, then pi zero will label the codimension one defects, and these are, you know, the familiar domain walls in the system. Similarly, if we have a U1 symmetry which is spontaneously broken down to nothing, then we can have a codimension two defect. And so here I've drawn these are the vortices which I've drawn here. And as a final sort of example, if we have a SO3 symmetry, which you can find in some ordinary ferromagnet or antiferromagnet, and it picks out a particular direction, the symmetry is broken down to SO2, the coset space is this, it's this coset, and which is S2 actually. And so these pi two will determine the codimension two textures. So this is an example of which is this magnetic skirmion. So essentially in this context of ordered phases, if we want to understand, you know, what's the kind of possibilities of all the defects that can arise in the system, we need to understand, you know, this homotopy groups of this coset space. And the coset space is sort of like the space of possible ground states.
I ask about that? Question about that, like here, if you spontaneously break a symmetry, then you have, Goldstone modes. Like you have these are actually dynamical excitations of the system, but in this parameter SPT, you don't normally think of a parameter as being a dynamical field.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So So normally what we'd also have, we'd have like a Goldstone, which lives, the Goldstone field kind of lives in this coset. That's right. But if I'm just talking about the topological defects, then the space of topological defects, then I can kind of forget about the Goldstone dynamics. And I can imagine.
In some sense, these topological defects are kind of like a topological Goldstone. Maybe that's just terminology. I was just saying that these topological defects are actually, because the field, order parameter field, is a dynamical field, these topological defects are dynamical excitations of the system, which seems different from the usual story people do for these parameter SPTs.
I'd agree with you. I think if I want to make this analogy like kind of exact, I would add a symmetry breaking field, a small symmetry breaking field, which gaps out the system and gets rid of the Goldstone dynamics. And then these defects are really just defects.
Right.
Right. So to draw like an analogy with this discussion earlier, you know, one might imagine that non-trivial homotopy groups in the space of quantum systems could also lead to interesting defects in textures. And in fact, this was recently formalized this year by this group of mathematicians and physicists who really make a correspondence between, you know, between this pi k of quantum systems and, you know, the associated interesting defects in textures. So these would include examples where, say, you have some something like a projective representation, you know, at the center of the vortex, or some charge associated to the skirmion and things like that. So these kinds of interesting defects and textures are related to these pi k of quantum systems. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced everyone that this problem is interesting. So let me kind of jump to the next part of the talk to define what we call parameterized systems. So a parameterized system really is nothing but a gapped family of Hamiltonians, a continuous gapped family of Hamiltonians. So we think of it as a map from X, which is some parameter space, to the space of gapped Hamiltonians. And we should think of X as like a set of parameters that, you know, some hypothetical all-powerful experimentalist has control over. So X might parameterize like the magnetic fields or you know, inter-site couplings and things like that. And we should imagine that, you know, maybe an experimentalist has the ability to go between different points of X. So given a notion of a system over X, a parameterized system, we can define when two such systems are in the same phase. So just by analogy with the ordinary definition of phase, if H1 and H2 are in the same phase over X, if they can be deformed into one another while preserving the gap everywhere over X. And this preserving the gap everywhere here is important. And once we define a notion of phase, we can label one of these as trivial. And so we'll say that a system over X is trivial if two conditions, if it's constant as a function of X, and the ground state is a product state. So we'll see in a little bit that actually both of these conditions are important. So to kind of convince everybody that this is not really some exotic construction or anything, we can look at particular examples of X and see that in fact, we're actually already a little bit familiar with them. So if we take X to be a point, then, you know, if we're trying to classify phases over X, this reduces to the ordinary classification of phases. So in this schematic diagram, you know, if I have a system over a point, then, you know, that's like just specifying some Hamiltonian, you know, in one of these phases. So classifying, you know, what are the systems over a point is really the same thing as classifying phases as we know it. Another kind of familiar example we can do is we take X to be S1. And these non-trivial examples of these are things like quantum pumps, as an example of the Thales charge pump. So what could happen is we here have drawn like a, you know, a family of Hamiltonians parameterized by some periodic parameter. And one manifestation of this family being kind of non-trivial is that, say, if this loop were to represent the Thales charge pump, as we sort of tune the parameter slowly and we, you know, traverse one cycle of this S1, what can happen is we pump one unit of charge. And this is what happens in the Thales charge pump. We pump one unit of charge across the system. And the reason that this means that the system is non-trivial is that, well, charge is quantized, so I can't adiabatically deform my system so it turns from pumping one unit of charge to pumping zero units of charge. So that's what makes the system non-trivial. And if you viewed in this, you know, in this pictorial way, you can think of this as being an obstruction to taking this loop and just shrinking it to a point. So if there's an obstruction to taking this loop and shrinking it to a point, there's kind of like a protected gapless point in the middle. And this is known in the literature as a diabolical point. Okay, so these are a couple of sort of hopefully familiar, I'm sure they're familiar examples of parameterized systems. Let me now move to an even more familiar, but seemingly trivial example of a parameterized system. And this is sort of this classic Berry phase example in zero dimensions. So we take our parameter space to be the two sphere S2, And the point in S2 labels a direction that we apply a magnetic field in. And so the Hamiltonian becomes this W dot sigma, where the sigma are the Pauli matrices. And, you know, as long as W is, say, a unit vector, this Hamiltonian is always gapped. And therefore, this gives a valid parameterized system. So it's gapped everywhere in parameter space. So as we all know, there's a phase invariance associated with this family of Hamiltonians. And this is given by the Chern number. You can compute this in a variety of ways. But importantly, this Chern number takes on a quantized value. And for this system, it's 2 pi. And this quantized non-zero value really indicates that this is in a non-trivial phase. It's in a non-trivial phase over S2. And what this is telling us is that it's impossible to deform this system into a constant family over S2. And an example of a constant family would be where, you know, regardless of what direction of W is inputted, the resulting Hamiltonian is just, say, sigma z, the Pauli matrix in the z direction. And the reason, of course, that this is it's impossible to deform it into this Hamiltonian is because this Hamiltonian the constant Hamiltonian has a zero Chern number, whereas our original system has a non-zero Chern number. Okay, so let me now turn to a kind of familiar consequence of this non-zero Chern number. So we can consider the wave function of the ground state of this Hamiltonian on the north over this S2. And for now, we can try to write down what the wave function is on the north and south hemispheres. So on the northern hemisphere, we can kind of write down the wave function exactly. It's given by this expression. And similarly on the south hemisphere, we can also write down the wave function exactly. And importantly, on the overlapping region, which is sort of like the equator of this S2, these two wave functions represent the same state because it's the ground state of that Hamiltonian. And if they represent the same state, then they're related by this phase, e to the I phi. They're related by some phase, and the phase turns out to be e to the I phi. So on this overlap, these wave functions are related by this e to the I phi. And what's interesting to note is that this e to I phi is a function which has non-trivial winding around the equator. And it's this non-trivial winding which is really encodes an obstruction to finding a globally well-defined wave function. So in fact, there's an obstruction to trying to take this wave function on the northern hemisphere and trying to extend it so that it works over the entire sphere. And similarly for the wave function of the southern hemisphere. So it's possible to formalize this idea of an obstruction in terms of a mathematical object called a line bundle. So in fact, the ground state wave functions of this 0D parameterized system, they form a mathematical structure called a line bundle. A bundle always, of course, consists of a base space and a fiber. So the base space is the collection of ground state density matrices, which are uniquely specified by the Hamiltonian. And the fiber over each base point is the set of ground state wave functions associated to that density matrices. So there's a kind of U1 number of ground state wave functions associated to each ground state. And that gives the fiber of this. And the non-triviality of the line bundle, or in other words, when this Chern number is zero, this is an obstruction to finding a globally well-defined ground state wave function, as we saw. So the 0D example is sort of can be sort of completely understood within this mathematical framework of line bundles. Okay, so now let me move to a more non-trivial example, and this will be the Chern number pump. So now the setting is we're looking at a one-dimensional system. When we want a one-dimensional system, which is we want to construct a one-dimensional system which is non-trivial. So we'll take our parameter space to be S3 rather than S2 in the zero-dimensional case. And we'll label our points of S3 with these two numbers, or with these two quantities. One is a three-component vector, W, with a vector. And the other one is a W4. And they satisfy this constraint that the sums of squares equal to 1. And that's what really tells us that we're living on S3. So now let me write down a Hamiltonian for this as a function of points on S3. So I'll start with the equator, the Hamiltonian defined in this sort of equatorial region. So when we're looking in the region where W4 is between minus a half and a half, the Hamiltonian is extremely simple. It's just a sum of on-site magnetic fields. So within each unit cell, I have two spins. And on the yellow spins, I have a W dot sigma Hamiltonian. And on the blue spins, I have a minus W dot sigma Hamiltonian. And this Hamiltonian is just completely on-site. And the ground state is just a product state of these systems. And note that there's no dependence on W4, only on W vector. Okay, so on the lower hemisphere, as we sort of move down toward the South Pole, we'll add something to the Hamiltonian. We'll add this, intra-unit cell Heisenberg exchange interaction. So this is some anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction between the two spins living inside a unit cell. When we turn this term on, the tendency is for these two spins to want to become to turn into a singlet. So importantly, we don't turn on any inter-unit cell interactions. It's just all the interactions is sort of taking place within a single unit cell. And as we move down toward the South Pole is the point where W4 equals minus one. But because we live on S3, that also means that W vector is zero. So at the South Pole, these magnetic field terms turn off, and we're left only with this anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction. And so at the South Pole, the wave function really is a bunch of spin singlets in this product state. Okay, and you guys might be able to tell where this is going. So on the northern hemisphere, we sort of do the same thing. We keep these on-site magnetic field terms, but we add this anti-ferromagnetic exchange interaction, but this time on the inter-unit cell spins, on the inter-unit cell bonds. And once again, as we move up toward the top hemisphere, as we move up to the top hemisphere, these magnetic field terms turn off, and we're only left with this anti-ferromagnetic interaction. And at the North Pole, we have our ground state will just be a bunch of spin singlets once again, but now they're kind of a staggered half a unit cell. They live in between the unit cells. Okay. So let me just go over a few statements about this model. So this forms a system over S3. We can check, this system sort of initially feels kind of trivial because at every point in parameter space, the ground state is just some product state of dimers. So even in this northern hemisphere, the ground state is just going to be a product state over these dimers which live in between the unit cells. So because this the ground state is always a product state, we can compute the spectrum exactly, and we can verify that it's gap. So in fact, we have this non-trivial family of gap systems over S3. Now, what actually makes this system a little bit non-trivial is that there's a non-trivial edge mode associated to this. So to see this, we can kind of look at, say, focus our attention on this right boundary for a second. So now imagine that this chain lives on a finite lattice rather than some periodic lattice. We live on a finite open chain, and because we now live on an open chain, this spin doesn't talk to anything. There's no partner spin to make this a singlet. So in fact, the only Hamiltonian term acting on this spin in the northern hemisphere is the magnetic field term, but that magnetic field term vanishes when you get to the North Pole, as we discussed. So in fact, if we just look at the boundary of this, this right boundary of the model, the right boundary becomes gapless once we reach this North Pole. And in fact, so does this left boundary. But what's interesting is that if we look at the full S3, if we focus our attention on this right boundary, the Hamiltonian is only gapless in one point of this S3. and that's the North Pole. Over the rest of S3, this boundary is totally gapped. And it's you can argue that this is impossible for a standalone zero-dimensional system. And that sort of indicates that this zero-dimensional boundary of this one-dimensional system has some kind of anomaly. And it's possible, and this should be kind of very reminiscent of SPT physics, and there's definitely an analogy to be made there. So this edge mode being, this non-trivial edge mode being there should sort of convince you that this system is non-trivial. And in fact, there's already a proposed phase invariant for this family of systems. This is given by this Kapustin-Svodenko higher Berry curvature invariant. And because our system is, you know, essentially it's just a bunch of product states, we can compute what this invariant is exactly, and we obtain the value 2 pi. And so that's sort of another check that the system is non-trivial. And in fact, in this paper, we developed a bulk boundary correspondence between these two facts. So the fact that we have this non-trivial edge mode is really related to this this bulk invariant that they define in this. Cool. So this is an example of a one-dimensional lattice model parameterized by S3, which is somehow non-trivial. And so kind of by analogy with the zero-dimensional case, we want to ask this question, or you might wonder about this question. Well, what is it that this higher Berry curvature obstructs? So if you recall, in the zero-dimensional case, the ordinary Berry curvature, it obstructed finding a global wave function for the system. So a natural question is there some similar interpretation for this higher Berry curvature? And, you know, en route to answering this question, we might also wonder, what's the mathematical structure associated to families of gapped one-dimensional systems, in the same way that the line bundle was the answer in the zero-dimensional case. So these are the questions that I want to kind of address in this moving forward. And
maybe before you move on, can I ask?
Yeah, please.
For the 1D example you mentioned, since you mentioned the analogy with SPT, is there a kind of response theory type of understanding? It's non-trivial because if I hit the system with something, it responds in some funny way. Is there such a picture?
Yeah. So let me think about how to... Right. So okay, in the ordinary theory of SPTs, the response, the thing that we hit it with is the background gauge field. In this case, there's no symmetry and no background gauge field, but what we have is this kind of parameter space. So what we can hit it with instead is we can try to vary the parameters slowly in space and in time. And in the kind of effective field theory description for this model, we expect that the response theory for this is captured by a kind of Westermino-Witten term for this parameter space S3. I can't really describe what it is like, you know, right now, but we can definitely talk about it later. But yeah, I mean, the response theory is related to a Westermino-Witten term.
But is there anything we can say like more physical? I mean, it's a kind of hard to say like what does this Westermino-Witten term really mean, except that it captures the higher Berry curvature, which is kind of simple. Like, is there some physical thing that we can measure or something?
Yeah. So maybe let me slightly change the question. And redirect it to this zero-dimensional case, right? So in the zero-dimensional case, we know that there's this system that has some Berry curvature associated to it. And maybe the question is there, you know, something, and again, in there, there's also some Westermino-Witten term associated to the zero-dimensional normal Berry curvature example. But there we can ask like, okay, is there something we can do to probe the system so that the meaning of this Westermino-Witten term becomes kind of physically apparent, right? So in the zero-dimensional case, actually what we can do is we can sort of do a kind of interference experiments to extract this higher Berry to extract the Berry phase associated with the system. So what we do is we slowly, you know, vary the parameter in time, and then we associate to this path some phase, which we can extract via some interference experiment. So one way of phrasing this question is, well, can we do something similar in this higher Berry curvature context, right? Can we extract some phase which we'll know to be related to this Wessem-Witten term or this response theory? Can we extract some phase, you know, with some hypothetical thought experiment in an analogous way for the zero-dimensional case? I think at the moment this is an open problem. I have some ideas on how to do it, which involve kind of varying the parameters slowly adiabatically in both space and time. So I believe the answer is yes, but this also sort of still needs to be formalized. And yeah, as we mentioned, the answer, the phase that you get, you know, out of this hypothetical thought experiment would also be related to this this Wessem-Witten response theory.
Thanks.
Yeah. And I'm happy to talk about it more later. Okay. So now, based on this outline, you might have a guess as to what this higher Berry curvature, you know, is obstructing. So let me now move to matrix product states and as a description for these parameterized systems. So matrix product states are a theoretical and numerical tool for quantitatively understanding one-dimensional gap ground states. So one-dimensional gap ground states can be very efficiently represented using matrix product states. So they provide a very useful ansatz for gapped one-dimensional states. So the ansatz is we take some matrix or some set of matrices AI, and A is going to be a three-index tensor, or each AI is a matrix, and these internal indices alpha and beta, they run from one to chi, which is something, it's an integer that we just call the bond dimension of A. And diagrammatically, A can be sort of represented like this. And in this trace, what we're doing is we put these bunch of A's next to each other, and we sum over the repeated indices where the legs are contracted. So this is some ansatz, very useful ansatz for one-dimensional ground states. And it turns out that this bond dimension, chi, this bond dimension is, what it's really doing is it's quantifying how much entanglement is present in the system. So we can, because our model, this Chern number pump, is exactly solvable, we can try to construct, you know, matrix product state representations of this model for various regions of parameter space. So within the northern hemisphere, within the northern hemisphere, we can sort of exactly write down this a description of the matrix product state diagrammatically. I've just drawn it like this, and because there's this entanglement in this northern hemisphere between the two unit cells, this matrix product state will be bond dimension two. Okay, and similarly, we can examine the wave function in the lower hemisphere and try to write down a matrix product state description. And here's a matrix product state. And what you notice is that now, because there's no entanglement between the neighboring unit cells, this matrix product state is actually bond dimension one. So so we can write down these expressions for the matrix product states exactly as a function of parameter space, in a similar way that we did with the wave function for a zero dimensional spin and magnetic field. So because the matrix product states, they represent the same states on the equator, in this overlapping region, these two matrix product states represent the same state. And so there has to be some kind of relation between these two NPS. And it turns out that instead of it, them being related by a phase, they're related by a pair of matrices V and W, which are called a reduction. So, right. So the NPS on the northern and southern hemisphere are related by reduction matrices V and W, and because V and W, you can always redefine them. You know, I can multiply V by either I phi and W by either minus I phi. This V and W are actually, they're only well defined up to a phase. Oh, and the fact that they're related by this reduction matrices V and W, this is like some theorem in the of matrix product states, which we sort of borrow from somewhere else. Okay, so diagrammatically, what this V and W are, this VW and these matrix product state have this relation. So V and W what they do is that they project the bond indices from this bond dimension 2 object to this bond dimension 1 object. And so intuitively, W and V are like 2 by 1 matrices, which kind of project this two-dimensional space onto this one-dimensional space. So we can write down, if we squint this 2 by 1 matrix, we can sort of think of it as like a state in a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Like a state is also kind of like a 2 by 1 matrix. So kind of if we squint, we can kind of write down W in this form, which is a bit suggestive. So in fact, this W will carry a phase ambiguity with it, as we mentioned in the previous slide. But the phase ambiguity for this W is identical to the phase ambiguity of the ground state wave function for a spin a half particle in a magnetic field. Or in other words, this expression for W carries some turn number associated to it. And actually, the way I've written it, W really is the wave function for a spin in a magnetic field. So it's really nice that it makes this appearance in this reduction matrix, when we relating the two NPS descriptions. So the reduction, which relates these two NPS description, carries a non-zero turn number. And this should sort of remind you of the phase carrying a non-zero winding number in the zero-dimensional Berry curvature case. And so this reduction carrying a turn number is actually an obstruction to choosing a globally well-defined NPS representation. So this is this kind of answers the question that I posed in the on the earlier slide. What is it that the higher Berry curvature obstructs? The claim is that it obstructs a globally well-defined continuous NPS representation.
So I think maybe you have mentioned it. Here you are only talking about W. What about the V?
Oh yeah. So W and V, it turns out are related. So W is sort of like the complex conjugate or the transpose of V. So actually they're in this case they're like the same information.
Okay.
Also in general they're not nicely related as like they're not necessarily like the transpose of each other, but they carry the same phase information. So the kind of phase ambiguity of W is the same as the phase ambiguity for V. And so we actually really only need to consider one of them to extract the information. But in this case, both W and V are kind of like, they kind of look like ground state wave functions in a spin a half in a magnetic field.
Uh-huh. So for a given physical dimension, is there any requirement in the dimension of the parameter space in order to see the non-trivial family?
Yeah, good question. So in zero dimensions, we want a two-dimensional family. And in one dimension, we are looking over S3, which is a three-dimensional family. And this pattern continues for this kind of obstruction. This pattern continues. So for a d-dimensional system, there's a possibility for a family over, say, SD plus 2.
I see, and this kind of dimensional reduction picture always holds.
So it's hard to make statements about always in higher dimensions because we have so much less control over tensor networks than we do for matrix product states. However, what we can do and what we showed in the paper is the higher dimensional analog of this model that the higher dimensional analog of this Chern number pump, which I described earlier, you can do a pretty much identical dimensional reduction picture where on the overlap now, rather than having like a zero dimensional thing, on the overlap, we have a one dimensional thing, which is precisely this Chern number pump, actually. So for very special cases, we can kind of continue to do this dimensional reduction picture, but we don't have like a general, we don't have the picture in full generality because we don't have as much control over tensor networks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So W is a unitary operator, right?
W is not unitary. It's a 2x1 matrix. So this MPS on the left-hand side has a bond dimension 2, and the MPS on the right-hand side has bond dimension 1. And this W is really kind of turning this two-dimensional bond index into a one-dimensional bond index.
Okay.
So I see, but I think I know where this question is coming from. So if I had two MPS, which are injective, and they describe the same state, then you know this V and W would be gauge transformations, and those would be unitary. So there's like a fundamental theorem of injective MPS, which says that if I have two injective MPS which represent the same state, then they are necessarily related by a gauge transformation, and then V and W would be unitaries. And in that situation, there's also a phase ambiguity for V and W, and so it's common to say that actually this gauge transformation lives in PUN rather than UN. But what's different in this case is that actually this left hand side is not injective because we're using bond dimension 2 MPS to represent a state which actually is sort of bond dimension 1, has no entanglement. And that's why these W is no longer unitary. It's like, it's kind of this, it's kind of like a projection.
So is it clear that the obstruction survives even if you enlarge the bond dimension?
Oh, that's a good question. So okay, there's sort of two ways I can try to address this question. So one is if we say we take this same system, let's say we take the same system, but we use a kind of different matrix product state representation. We just use another representation which has more bond dimension that we need. And in this case, the obstruction will still survive. You can still show that this V and W will carry this Chern number as in this case. There's a sort of other kind of related question, which is, well, oftentimes you have gapped states, gapped one-dimensional states, which can be kind of approximated by a finite bond dimension MPS, but it's not exact, right? If I really want to get the exact state, I need to, keep all infinite bond dimension. And then to sort of do this procedure, I would need to like kind of truncate the bond dimension in order to do so. And in that case, this is quite subtle. So we didn't address that case in our paper. In our paper, we really only address the case where the ground state wave function has an exact representation in terms of MPS with finite bond dimension. But I guess to address the first question was, if we kind of extend these bond indices by some amount, then the obstruction is still there.
And how, and then is the translational symmetry also crucial here?
So, yeah, I mean, I guess. I mean, it's sort of crucial in making our lives easier. It's not crucial in terms of the obstruction. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I haven't really thought too much about like how exactly to do this in the non-translation invariant case. Like there we might need like, different A's as a function of lattice site, for example. So certainly translation symmetry is crucial in making my life easier, but I don't believe it's crucial for this invariant, and it's sort of expected not to be crucial for the invariant based on classification arguments and TQFT and stuff like that.
Okay, thank you.
So, if I try to understand this more pictorically without using necessarily the MPS language or tensor network, can I say that this looks like you have some globally well-defined local density matrices, but the Schmidt states cannot be globally defined?
Yeah, I think that is I think that is the right way to do this. So I think what the right way to say it in that language is that, for every value of parameter space, I can have some kind of local density matrix associated to some patch. Sorry, to some, how do I say, to some interval in real space. Let's say I have some density matrix associated to for each value of parameter space. And the Schmidt vectors, or basically if I try to split this density matrix into pure states, the pure states have some phase ambiguity to it. So I think that's the right interpretation, and this is actually also related to this question earlier of like what's the some hypothetical experiment you can do to extract the higher Berry phase. But yeah, I think roughly that should be it, and it would be really nice to formalize this.
Okay, thanks.
Does that also mean the entanglement Hamiltonian has to close gap or something like that?
Oh yeah, very good. Yeah, so I didn't mention that here, but it's true that the entanglement Hamiltonian does have to close the gap. It's sort of a consequence here of the fact that the bond dimension changes from 2 to 1. That's sort of reflecting the fact that the entanglement Hamiltonian, that the gap in the entanglement Hamiltonian closes.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that's sort of another way to see the non-triviality in the language of MPS, at least for this specific example. So yeah, with the remaining time I have left, let me just kind of sketch out what the general structure of this. So if we kind of collect all of the MPS representations for the ground states of a parameterized 1D system, we can assemble this into the data for a mathematical object called a gerb. And a gerb is kind of a supposed to be, it's a generalization of a line bundle in a sense. It's not quite as intuitive, but let me try to sketch out what it looks like. So let's start with some open cover for our parameter space. In our S3 example, this was just the north and south hemispheres, but this could be just some random open cover. The hope is that on each open cover, we have a continuous set of MPS tensors that describe the state on each for each point in parameter space. And the idea is that on the double overlaps where I have two MPS tensors which describe the same state, I can associate to it a line bundle. And this line bundle is the line bundle of reductions, this V and W matrices, which appeared. So these A and B will be related by some V and W, and the line bundle of these V and Ws is what we assign to the double overlaps. And then finally, there's some isomorphisms on triple overlaps between these line bundles, and these isomorphisms satisfy a co-cycle condition, and it's really these latter two pieces of data, or I guess it's, sorry, I guess it's all three. The structure, the data of a gerb is like a open set, or sorry, an open cover, line bundles on the double overlaps, and then these isomorphisms on the triple overlaps. And there's a precise sense in which this you can write down the data for a line bundle in a very similar way, and then it's clear how a gerb generalizes that. So from this data of the previous slide, you can associate a invariant called this Dixmier-Duity class, and this lives in the third cohomology of X. And you know, this invariant is sort of in line with our expectations from the classification of phases, and in some cases we can also obtain this three cocycle or this invariant by integrating a higher barrier curvature three form, and that was the case in this churn number pump. But there are some cases where you can't obtain it by integrating a higher barrier curvature three form. And so the claim is that if we have some higher barrier curvature, and by that I just mean we have some non-trivial element of this H3, then this gives an obstruction to a global MPS representation. And the argument is quite simple. It's that if we have a non-trivial element of here, well, then, or sorry, it's if we have a global MPS representation, then the class in here is trivial. And, you know, by, yeah, and the converse or the contrapositive is if we have something that is non-trivial here, then it can't be, we can't have gotten it from deforming something that comes from a global MPS representation. And so,
question. Why is the coefficient C?
Okay. This is probably an unsatisfying answer, but I guess it's the same. It's the same reason that the coefficient in the line bundle case is also Z. Are you asking, like, for example, why it's not U1? For example.
Why is it not U1 or even R? I don't know.
Oh, I see. Okay, so let me, yeah. So based on the data of the previous slide, you know, this line bundles on overlaps and isomorphisms. What you can do is you can construct a check cohomology class. So this is a class in H2 of X with U1 coefficients, and then it turns out that that group is isomorphic to here. And so this H2 of X with U1 is, like, you should think of that as kind of generalizing the classification of SPTs, where we know it's the SPTs are sort of classified by the second cohomology of the group with U1 coefficients. And here we've sort of replaced the group with parameter space.
I see. Thanks.
I mean, ultimately, it all traces back to the fact that quantum mechanics has this U1 phase ambiguity, right?
That's right.
And then Z is like the pi one of that.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so that, this last section was a little bit brief, but that sort of concludes my talk. I just want to say MPS provide a powerful framework for understanding these 1D systems in general. The non-triviality of this turn number pump is captured by this turn number of the transition line bundle, or the turn number of these the V and W reduction matrices. And we can associate a gerb structure to MPS, to families of MPS of parameterized 1D states. So brief comment on further directions. There were some which involved some future directions that were sort of touched on during the talk, is, you know, how to develop like a hypothetical experimental thought experiment, which extracts a higher Berry phase. And that's related to, you know, writing down a connection, a gerb connection for this for this kind of system. And also let me just highlight that there was some work by Shuhei and Ken earlier this year also, which appeared roughly the same time as our papers, slightly earlier, in which they have some complementary perspectives. And they have some really nice pictures in there as well. So lastly, before I conclude, let me sort of just mention how parameterized systems, not just this kind of the kind of which I talked about in this talk, but can appear in other fields. So if I have a family of topological orders parameterized by S1, these are related to constructions of flow K codes. And one question that I'd like to understand is it possible to kind of extend this correspondence to more general families like S1 times S1 or something like that, or S2. Another question is that, which I didn't really go into this talk, but the construction of the turn number pump, it kind of involves, well, it involves pumping lower dimensional systems. In this case, it pumped like a zero dimensional Berry phase. And I want to understand, well, can this, is it possible in some cases to make sense of this for non-invertible defects? And finally, this I feel like maybe of particular interest to Perimeter, the higher Berry curvature example of this turn number pump can arise from perturbing a deconfined quantum critical point. And so, you know, I'd wonder, could this lead to new perspectives, at least, if not new constructions of different kinds of deconfined quantum criticality? So I'd be happy to talk about these directions later. But yeah, that's the actual conclusion of the talk. So thanks so much for listening, and thanks for all the questions as well.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Marvin. Let me begin by asking about this slide.
Yeah.
Like for parameter space is always like the, I mean, in the topological spaces, the homotopy groups are always like in groups, right? So it seems like to get non-invertible defects, you would have to generalize the parameter space to some structure that doesn't have group homotopy.
Yeah. So okay. So I can say what I mean in this case. So I'm still thinking about like a parameter space with just like a normal topological space as parameter space. But what I kind of have in mind here is that, you know, all sorts of these I guess actually all examples that I know of non-trivial families of gapped systems, they all involve kind of pumping some lower dimensional thing. So either it's a pumping charge or pumping an SPT or pumping some domain wall, for example, through the system. And these are all invertible defects. So the question I have in mind here is there, can I think of other kinds of parameterized systems which involve pumping something that looks like a non-invertible defect? And so I can think of one example where this is a kind of appears. So for example, if I take my two-dimensional toric code, say, I could write down a family parameterized by S1, which pumps a EM duality defect through the system. And the EM duality defect is invertible. And actually this is related to these flow K codes. But one thing I could do is I could maybe look at the boundary of this system, and the EM duality defect kind of should end on a non-invertible defect on the boundary. And then the question is, well, on this boundary, can I think of this as being as pumping some non-invertible defect through the system? And, you know, is it possible to think of examples beyond this kind of example, maybe like in a way where I don't need this 2D bulk, for example. That's the kind of setting that I'm kind of wondering for this. But
well, what I'm suggesting is that if you have a system that's parameterized by a topological space, you should not be able to pump it non-invertible defects, because the topological space itself is kind of invertible. But anyway, maybe we can talk about that more later.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that more later. Yeah, you're saying because the homotopy groups are groups, so that's the sense in which they're invertible.
Right.
Okay, I see.
Yeah. So, anybody else have questions?
So I have my question. So in your example of S3, so the equator is S2, right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And what is the target space that when you map the MPS from the northern hemisphere to the MPS in the southern hemisphere? So what is the map from S2 to what?
Oh, I see. Right. Oh, I understand the question. Okay. So great question. Yeah. So on the overlap, you're basically asking what space does this V and W live in? Is that right? Mm-hmm. So the V and W, Right. Okay. So in this case, because of how the dimensions work out, so the MPS in the northern hemisphere is bond dimension 2. MPS in the southern hemisphere is bond dimension 1. So what this the V and W, they map, these are maps from S2, which is the equator, to CP1. And the 1, I think, is from 2 minus 1. And in general, if I have bond dimension like D1 and D2, this will map into some kind of, I believe, yeah, it'll map into a Stiefel manifold, which is some quotient of, it's a quotient of like these frame bundles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we described this in our general construction in our paper. Yeah. So the V and W map into these kinds of Stiefel spaces or quotients of the Stiefel space.
And what is relevant is pi 2 of that space.
Right? Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And rather
it's H2, the second cohomology class of these spaces is what's relevant, I think. I think it's the second cohomology and not the second homotopy, but I don't think that distinction is that important.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question.
Hey, more questions? So let me ask one. So if you consider one-dimensional states parameterized by BG, where BG is a classifying space of a group G, you should recover the the usual SPD classification.
Yeah, it's the expectation. Yeah.
Yeah, because H3 of BG coefficients in Z is the same as H2 of G coefficients in U1, so it will work out. But I'm wondering, is there a relationship between that and usual treatment in MPS of SPTs of G symmetry? Like, it's not very obvious how they're connected, at least to me.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that statement. So I definitely even forgetting about MPS for the moment, I don't know how to say write down a Hamiltonian which depends on elements of BG.
There is at least a formal way to do it, but we can discuss it.
Yeah. I mean, I understand the interpretation is supposed to be that, BG kind of parameterizes all the possible domain wall insertions you can have. Domain wall insertions that you can have in the system, right? So I guess maybe that would lead to, I don't know how it works. I don't know formally how it works, but that's the sort of intuitive picture that I've been told. But I guess that's what would lead to how you could write down a Hamiltonian in terms of BG.
Okay, any more questions? It seems not, so yes, we can't really thank him, but thank you, Marvin, for the nice talk, and many of us will talk to you in the next day or two.
Great. Thank you so much it's a pleasure talking.